Well, all right, Dr. Schneider, it's 5 after,
Okay.
so I guess we'll go ahead and call this meeting to order. Do we want to
Yes,
do
ma'am.
introductions first or go through and see if we have a quorum here, take attendance?
Mark, would you go ahead with the members?
Sure, I'd be glad to. I'll call everybody in alphabetical order by the last name, so just speak up when I call your name. Mr. Rob Vinke. Mr. Rob Vinke?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Dr. Lisa Bellner.
Okay. Present.
Dr. John Brophy.
Yo.
Dr. Richard Cole. Dr. Sarecia Cummings.
Here.
Ms. Lisa Hartman. Dr. Jeff Hazelwood.
Here.
Mr. Dan Hedrick. I thought I saw Mr. Dan Hedrick on the
Here.
screen here. Okay,
Yep.
good,
Yeah,
good.
I just had trouble unmuting.
All right, Ms. Jenny Howard.
Here.
Dr.
Hello,
Tim
stranger.
Jones.
Tim Jones here.
Dr. Greg Kaiser. Ms. Amy Moses. I thought I saw Ms. Amy Moses on the screen.
Yes.
Are you with us? She's
Yeah,
I
here.
see her. She's waiting.
Ms. Karina Sloat.
Here.
Dr. Robert Snyder.
Here.
And Dr. Snyder, I understand you hold the proxy for Dr. Wills Oglesby.
Yes.
Ms. V. Story.
Here.
Dr. Jim Talmadge.
Here.
And Dr. David Tudor. Okay, so I count. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. 14 out of 18, so that is sufficient for a quorum. We may proceed.
All right.
Okay. So,
Introductions.
okay, the individuals that aren't recognized, Hunter, would you identify yourself?
Yes, hey Robert. Lee Hunter, I'm an orthopedic surgeon from KOA in Columbia,
Okay.
Tennessee, and I'm just
Okay.
observing.
Okay. Thank you. And I think that's it.
All right. So I think the next thing we have on here is conflict of interest forms are
Lacey,
recurring.
yes. If you have
We
not filled it out, Lacey will be in touch with you.
have them all.
Yay!
Okay. Wow. Excellent. So, and then next would be the minutes from last meeting. Do we have an approval for that?
Move to approve, Brophy.
Murphy, and do we have a second?
I'll second, Rob Behnke.
Thanks, Rob. All right. Moving into old business, ODG update.
Okay, the first one I sent to you with the members were the changes that became effective October the 3rd for ODG. It included 100 or so different changes of topic and updates. I did highlight a couple things that were significant changes. And so has everybody had a chance to look at those? And does anybody have any comments? So the next page involved the second part of that was another set of updates that included spinal cord stimulators on a recommendation statement and also lumbar and sacroiliac fusions. And so comments on those updates. Well, it's the same stuff that you have there.
I've just been looking at the
guides
that are published in OBG as well.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But that's the same thing. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, is Mr. Prevo on?
I don't know.
Let me look.
I don't see him. I don't see
him
Troy.
Either.
Mm-mm. Okay.
So, I mean, the problem with the lumbar fusion section is that they address a lot of the issues that aren't pertinent to Tennessee with the fact that we don't cover aggravation of pre-existing condition, meaning degenerative mm-hmm. changes. So that takes off degenerative spondylolisthesis and other issues that they have listed, but they don't cover the one that would be most likely in state of Tennessee, and that's a second disc recurrence. And given that all the other fusion criteria require psychological evaluation and a second recurrence is generally quite painful, I would suggest that they need to address it specifically, that it will frequently require a fusion, and that it should be under the 6-week criteria of lumbar radiculopathy, and that no psychological evaluation should be required for that circumstance.
Other issues? Physical therapy?
Jim Talmadge, there are other issues with the ODG spine update. As I recall, the keeper of the minutes can correct me, but this committee last approved the ODG guidelines prior to the July 2024 update. And the July 2024, November 2024, April 2025, July 2025, and now October 2025 have not been approved by this committee. The lumbar fusion criteria for spondylolisthesis require imaging that's supposed to demonstrate spondylolisthesis, and they have in parentheses dynamic instability, but they don't clearly state you can do a fusion for spondylolisthesis with proven instability or without proven instability. Their method of documenting instability is standing flexion extension lateral radiographs. And many people with bad backs when standing for those flexion extension films move very little into flexion and very little into extension and don't demonstrate the instability that's there. So many spine surgeons have gone to comparing supine radiographs to standing neutral position radiographs that has a better yield at demonstrating true instability. In the spinal fusion for lumbar stenosis section, there is no caution about doing a fusion for stenosis as opposed to doing a simple decompression. despite multiple randomized controlled trials published that say outcomes are not better with fusion. There are more complications and slower recovery with fusion, and that simple decompression should be the recommended treatment, not fusion or stenosis. The criteria for having fusion frequently involve having a favorable psychologic evaluation. We raised this issue previously, but they still haven't addressed it. So the psychologic evaluation says no uncontrolled mental health or substance use disorder, but doesn't define uncontrolled. There's abundant literature that says major depressive disorder forecasts poor outcomes with lumbar fusion. And we see in appeal psychological evaluations that diagnose major depressive disorder on a questionnaire like the BHQ-9. You get a maximum possible score, severe depression. And a psychologist says, on an antidepressant, therefore okay to do the surgery. So uncontrolled should be defined. The psychologic report also is supposed to assess personality style and coping ability. I know of no literature that says personality style affects outcome. And what is personality style? Introvert versus extrovert? Myers-Briggs personalities? Personality style and coping ability are undefined terms. So this will let you are physicians say not certified, and we on appeal will have to try to define what ODG meant by personality style and coping ability. So there are still major problems with the ODG. Sacroiliac joint fusion requires imaging that shows pathology, but the older you are, the more degenerative changes you have. That's been well established. So if undefined degenerative changes are all that's needed, that means anybody over 40 probably qualifies. The older you are, the higher the incidence of spontaneous fusion of the SI joint, and there's no requirement that spontaneous fusion be excluded by CT scan. So theoretically, you could fuse surgically the SI joint that's already fused spontaneously. And they use response to injection of the SI joint as a criterion with no comment on the volume of injectate administered or whether you used x-ray dye and watched to see if it extravasates. Fortin, who's well known for SI joint issues, published back in 1999 that if you inject more than 3 cc's in the SI joint, it extravasates onto the lumbosacral plexus, the L5 nerve root, and the S1 nerve root. So, error available to make is to extravasate the eye and local anesthetic with the injection and get a false positive result. I think there is one published randomized controlled trial that is not manufacturer sponsored, and it found no benefit. All the manufacturer sponsored randomized trials found benefit. So it's a confusing area. And Washington State says simply, we don't cover it. So there are still, they've improved it, but there's still a lot of issues. And I think Dr. Brophy has a suggestion.
Well, to me, the biggest issue going forward is the fact that for a year we've been discussing the problem with 3 months of conservative management for radiculopathy. And during the last visit, Mr. Prevo implied that was going to be solved and we'd agreed that 6 weeks was reasonable. They changed it in the lumbar radiculopathy section, but did not change it in the cervical radiculopathy section. In addition, the minor issues about their therapy is has a big issue. But to me, for all those reasons, we should table approval of this version of the spine section till the next visit to see what ODG's going to actually change when they presumably said they were already going to do some of these things.
Jim, does ACOM guidelines, this is Hazelwood, do ACOM guidelines address all of these issues you just laid out?
There are frustrations with ACOM in Washington State, especially in with ACOM in terms of dealing with how to read it. So I think Mr. Prevo could get us on board with some straightforward changes that would make his guides much better for the treating. It's almost as I keep reading these things every meeting, it's like they don't have a physician, a surgeon who actually does the cases actively reading their literature because they would see the problems. It's like an administrative person or somebody just reviewing literature is doing it, not somebody who does the surgery. But so it could be fixed easily.
So there's a motion on the table to approve ODG changes with the exception of the spine section.
I'll second.
Okay.
All right. So are we ready to move on?
We kind of need a vote.
Oh, that might be important, right? I thought I heard Talmadge second that motion.
Correct.
Yes.
Anyone else?
Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, so I will write up these comments and send them on to Troy one more time.
Dr. Snyder, maybe you should suggest that whoever is ahead of this mind section actually talk to Dr. Brophy or to Dr. Brophy and me instead of everything going through Troy, a non-surgeon.
Okay, I will make that suggestion.
All right. So I think the next on here was a drug formulary update.
So I apologize that I was a couple days late getting the drug formulary published on our website. As a result, the changes that were effective on October the 3rd for ODG will become effective for the state of Tennessee on November the 1st. So just as of a couple days ago, those drug formulary updates then became effective.
Okay. Then we have cold compression, continuous flow cryotherapy.
So herein lies a very difficult situation. So for a long time, ODG had not approved cold compression therapy or for continuous flow. And so they finally updated the continuous flow. And so the problem is that the lay understanding and even the physician understanding is there's no separation or no distinction between cold compression therapy and continuous flow cryotherapy. Interestingly enough, ODG only makes an evaluation for cold compression therapy of the game ready unit and not of any other cold compression units. And so I have written to them and told them that they need to cross-reference the cold compression with the continuous flow cryotherapy to try to clear up this distinction without a difference. Most physicians, when they write an order, or most individuals, when they receive a unit, do not understand whether it's cold compression or whether it's continuous flow cryotherapy. And there's limited literature that there is a significant difference. One of the things that we have trouble with individual denials is when they include a sequential DVT prophylaxis, sequential compression devices in the same order. Mm-hmm. And as a result then, okay, is that somebody who's not muted, please mute. So as a result of that, there's confusion and there is denials from utilization review for sequential compression devices, which are standard of care for shoulder surgery and for the opposite knee in knee surgery. Yet they deny those because they confuse that with the cold compression units. So both of these things we have identified and sent to ODG to try to clarify. Karina, do you have anything else to add to that?
No, you're spot on, because we're seeing the same thing, you know, with in the insurance world too, with the same things being put on those orders, right, and causing confusion. I mean, the SCDs would be and should be considered, right, within the cold compression, but there needs to be a distinction between those devices, or more explanation within ODG to make it clear to other utilization review companies.
Well, it'd be nice if they would cross reference to the cold compression therapy between that and the continuous flow cryotherapy. There is some recent literature on the shoulder for cold compression, but it's only one article and it's not absolutely persuasive that it's any better than just continuous flow cryotherapy. Mm-hmm. The other problem has to do with the length of time that they're recommended. Our experience, our clinical experience, and my personal experience is that after about 10 to 14 days, you quit using it anyhow. Although, and that the recommendation under cold compression therapy is actually 2 weeks, which is okay. A lot of the reviewers then will just eliminate it, even though it's recommended for 30 days. There'd be very rare circumstances where somebody would continue to use it for 30 days, in the absence of other complications.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Agree.
So we're trying to see what we can do to get ODG to straighten out that problem.
Yeah, that's great. Excellent. Any more comments on the cold compression or anything else on that before we move to the next? Right. AMA Guides 6th, 2025.
As of approximately 3 weeks ago, the AMA has sent out a letter, and I'm going to read you one paragraph of this letter because it does impact exactly where we as a committee are with the AMA Guides update. So this is from the vice president of the AMA, and this is a quote. We believe this is the right moment to make a strategic pivot to protect and strengthen the value of the AMA guides by investing in the long-term support and accessibility of existing content. For example, initiatives such as implementing an FAQ section and earmarking the year when each chapter was updated are underway. By focusing resources where they will have the most impact, we can ensure that the current edition remains usable, relevant, and well-supported for all stakeholders. And so I bring this to your attention because it now appears that the content that has been released effective this year, that is AMA 6th, 2025, is going to be the stable content for a significant period of time going forward. That includes all three of the musculoskeletal chapters, which represent probably 90% of permanent impairment evaluations. It included the 2023 update to the neurology section, and it included a 2025 update to the pulmonary and ENT sections. So all of these will be stable content and be published on the AMA site. It is clear that the AMA is not going to actually publish a book. And so if somebody else is going to publish the book, they may get into it, but at this period of time, it's going to be the digital version. And so with that stable content, I open it to the committee as to where we go from here. Do we need to reevaluate these sections in light of the fact that the content is stable? Is the effort to change to a separate edition so overwhelming as to make it difficult to advise? As you well know, the way that the process works is the medical advisory committee is first to review these changes and make a recommendation. If the recommendation is positive, then it would go to the administrator for evaluation. The administrator then would have to call together a meeting of stakeholders. The stakeholders would then make a recommendation, another recommendation to the administrator. The administrator would then have to make that recommendation to the governor's office for the governor to put that in a legislative package. As you full well know, we will have a new governor in 2026. So actually it would be the legislative term for 2027. Okay. So we are talking about a process that even though we would recommend it, it would be at least a 3-year process at minimum, even if the comments and the suggestions to both the administrator were positive. So I open it up to the floor to people's comments on the whole process.
Jim Talmadge, I'll go first. I have not heard any Tennessee physician advocate that we should switch off the 2008 book. Dr. Snyder, you were going to ask the AMA what jurisdictions by law adopted the guides 2025 digital so we could see if they had a positive experience with that. Did the AMA ever answer your request?
No, but I do know the states of Wyoming, New Mexico, and Montana have adopted the 2025. And so I can get in touch with one of the physicians that works in Montana and see what their experience is so far. But that's as close as I've come.
If the committee is not familiar with the digital product, the MA took a 600-page book published in 2008 and transformed it into 1,500 pages of digital content by revising some of, but not all of the chapters. They did revise the psych chapter, which is, 2022, and is a good revision of that. But they've not revised the skin, the GI, the GU, a number of chapters that are potentially in need of revision, and just the sheer number of pages is a detractor. In addition, you can buy the 2008 book on Amazon for less than $200, or you can subscribe and have access to the digital content, but only for a year for considerably more money. So physicians aren't particularly happy with the fee schedule, at least the ones I've talked to about it. So any other committee thoughts?
Yeah, I can give my opinion, Jeff Hazelwood. I think number one, I like the book where I can make notes in the book, tag it, refer back to it. For me as an old man at 65, it's a lot easier to do that than trying to figure out how to do it digitally. Number two, I think I do several record reviews a month, and I'm shocked still how the old book is still misinterpreted all the time on the correct impairment ratings. Number three, I think that cost is a very important point. I think that's going to be a deterrent for a lot of doctors to invest in that. And then number four, an example of the confusion is you guys just put out the Admiral View newsletter on frequently asked questions and clarifications on basic things like spine and carpal tunnel. And still, doctors are not understanding how to appropriately apply these guides. And when I looked at the new guides, the revisions, as I said before, I was overwhelmed. And I don't know many people that are up to investing the time that has to be invested, going to courses, paying for the courses, et cetera, to learn all of that new stuff. So my opinion is table it. Give it time to settle out, see how the other three states that are doing it respond, and why is there a big rush on our end to change it when we're still having trouble with the old one?
For folks that aren't familiar with this, the guide issue, just FYI, Arkansas is using the fourth edition of the AMA guides from the 1990s.
Yes.
Still. So is Texas.
Yes.
Yeah. Although Alabama, Texas, too, I think. Alabama's fourth edition.
Mm-hmm.
Colorado and Oregon use the third edition revised, published in 1988.
Okay. So, Dr. Hazelwood, you want to go ahead and make a motion to table the evaluation and to await for more information?
Yes, I see no reason not to just slow down and wait. So I make a motion to table it and rediscuss it next meeting. Okay.
All right. Do we have a second?
I second that.
May I amend the motion and suggest that we table it until WCRI publishes a cost analysis of what happened in the states that switched compared to what they did have as an experience before they switched.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Talmadge. So you have asked for an amended motion.
Could I request that Dr. Talmadge remove WCRI and just say until a cost analysis is available?
Perfect.
All right. We have a motion to approve the amended motion.
I second it, Hazelwood.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Hazelwood. All right. Do we need to take a vote, Dr. Schneider?
Please.
All right. All those in favor of this new amended motion?
Aye.
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 Is there any opposed? I don't hear any. All right. So that is, sounds like we are tabled for that, and we'll move on. Medical fee schedule, Dr. Schneider.
So the medical fee schedule has been released by the Attorney General's office, and it's published on the Secretary of State's website. The fee schedule goes before the Government Operations Committee in December. The effective date of the new fee schedule of the rules themselves are January 19th of 2026. However, there is a provision in the new rules that all of the changes to the rules become effective with the publication of the rate tables on publication of the rate tables for April the 1st of 2026. So when you look at the fee schedule changes, be aware that they become effective April the 1st of 2026.
Okay.
There are a number of clarifications, and there is a number of simplifications in the fee schedule, reducing the number of separate professional payment levels from 6 to 3. And the other major change is to encode the certified physician program with its own modifier.
Okay. Any questions? Comments?
Can you provide a direct link for us technologically deficient 57-year-olds for the fee schedule?
Kyle, are you still on, or Lacey?
I can put it in the chat, Dr. Schneider. I'll be right back.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Amanda. All right. Any other questions or comments on the fee schedule?
Yeah, for E&M codes. Yeah.
Oh,
okay. Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't
hear any other comments or questions. questions on that. So I feel like we're good to move to case management and claim handling standards.
So new rules for case management become effective November the 10th. Lacey and Marche Jones, the program coordinator, have given, I believe it's five town hall meetings. And there's a sixth one for tomorrow. If you go to the Qatar website, then you can get the link to the town hall meetings. The major changes to the case management rules have to do with clarifications of certain roles. And the other big thing is the identification of face-to-face and virtual meetings. During COVID, obviously, we were not able to meet face-to-face. And so consequently, we suspended any penalties that had to do with violation of the face-to-face meetings and allowed virtual meetings that are two-way audio-visual that are satisfactory to the injured worker. We have codified that now so that it is clear what a virtual and acceptable virtual meeting is, as well as still the recommendation that in this time that the information gained by face-to-face interaction and communication with the injured worker benefits the system in identifying problems and also motivation and secondary issues. So please feel free to contact me if there's any question about the rules, and if you can you can go to the town hall meeting tomorrow, please do so. Just to let you know, starting in January, we will have town hall meetings for the medical fee schedule. So we are going to try to make that part of our rules rollout. And then the second part is claims handling standards. These are new rules, and this is 800-02-14. These also become effective on November the 10th, so just a week or less than a week away. The changes to the claim handling standards have to do with the adjuster responsibilities in responding to requests, and also in the adjuster's responsibility to identify the adjuster correctly when adjusters change. So we're trying to make it clear that the adjuster's responsibility is to notify not only the injured worker, but also the providers that are of record when it comes to changes in adjusters. So hopefully this will provide some clarity and some better effective system management.
Okay. Any questions or any comments on the case management and claim handling standards? That's November the 10th. And then I see some the meeting, town hall meeting is at 9 tomorrow. It's in the chat with a way to join. And then there's also the rule is also in there, too, if you want to look that up. No questions, comments? I think we're rolling right along. You are report.
The major one this time has to do with the failure of a utilization review advisory medical practitioner to properly apply the medical treatment guidelines. This is a case of a 22-year-old female who had a left shoulder injury and was actually suffered a dislocation and required a special operation called a Bankart procedure or Bankart lesion, Bankart repair for the shoulder. The reviewer used the wrong section. It's called a labral tear, which is not appropriate to the type of surgery that the individual had. And so as a result of that, we overturned the denied treatment. And in 2016, the Medical Advisory Committee approved the following recommendation, which was to notify the administrator that the utilization review physician had improperly applied the guidelines by clearly using the wrong diagnosis, citing the wrong procedure or section, or citing an inconsequential variation and failure to identify the major facts. In this circumstance, I'm asking for the Medical Advisory Committee to authorize me to recommend to the administrator that the a penalty be sent to the advisory medical practitioner that he clearly used the wrong diagnosis in citing the wrong section.
All right.
So I will need the action of the committee on that.
All right.
So,
do we have a motion to move forward?
Well, I can make the motion, so I'll make the motion to,
all right,
to
do we
send the penalty.
Okay. Do we have a second for that?
I'll second.
All right. Do we need to take that to a vote then, Dr. Schneider?
Please.
All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? I don't hear any opposed, so we're moving forward.
Can I ask if that UR reviewer was an orthopedic surgeon?
Yes, he was. I don't think he actually read the record is what I think what happened.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Mm-mm. All right.
So the next UR thing has to do with peer-to-peer. So this has been a stumbling block to every physician that tries to get a treatment approved. The system does not seem to work very smoothly. And so we had a meeting that had to do with the announcement that Sedgwick makes to their when they put in a denial of their a treatment. And so it had to do with the wording that Sedgwick used in identifying the timeframes involved in the peer-to-peer, which are not in line with the timeframes that are in our rules. And so they, with some discussion back and forth, they're going to revise how they word, how long they are going to allow a physician to contact Sedgwick about a peer-to-peer meeting. So we'll wait and see how that goes. But the second part that we identified, or that I've identified, that I don't have an answer for yet, has to do with leaving messages at physicians' offices. So one of the things that happens is that in the utilization review denial, the reviewer will list that they called a certain telephone number at the physician's office and left a message with a certain person at such date and such time. The problem with that is that they did not leave, or they do not identify the telephone number that an individual physician could call back and get an answer to the from that peer review physician or from their organization. And so at this point, we don't have that in any of the documents that I've seen where a reviewer would say, I called Dr. Brophy's office at 3 p.m. on Friday afternoon and left a message with Susan. Yet they did not leave the return telephone number. So we are going to suggest going forward that the reviewers leave the telephone number, that the number can be called back, because it's not clear that they're giving either the correct telephone number or listing a number that is other than the general phone number or mailbox for the review organization. So we're going to try to address that going forward. Okay. But at this time, I don't have a good answer for it. But it's something that I've identified, that we've identified as being a problem with the peer-to-peer system.
I agree with that, Dr. Schneider. We just aren't seeing that in our reports, too, that we get back and we're having to ask, you know, what number did you guys leave? So it'd be good to have that listed in the rules that, you know, a callback number must be identified.
Okay, great. That'll help us. Dr. Bellner, you had a comment?
Yeah, could you add one more thing with that? So they... In very small print on the bottom of the denials is that you have, the physician has either 24 hours or 48 hours to reopen that appeal. So when I spend an hour and a half waiting for Sedgwick, because it gave Sedgwick's phone number to call to reopen the appeal, they said that they don't handle those reopenings. It's being farmed out to another company. So they need to put on the, on that request to reopen the case, the correct phone number, so we know who to call to reopen that. Now, it did work. Once I got that phone number, I was able to reopen the appeal and actually speak with the physician who had never bothered to call the office the first time. It was the same physician, did call me back, but it was probably I spent 4 hours on a Friday afternoon getting that case reopened for that gentleman.
Good to know. Yes, we'll work on that. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
The problem is that I believe one of the problems is Sedgwick uses more than one physician review company. Okay. And as a result of that, then, it creates a second level of complication, and that's why when you called Sedgwick's first number, they said, well, we don't handle that. So we are going to try to straighten that out and continue working on this communication system.
All right. Do we need to move forward with motion to talk about language or just discuss this at future? Okay.
No. That's just – pretty much FYI for the committee that we've identified that and understand that it's a problem.
Yeah. Okay. Any other comments on that or any other UR portions to discuss? All right. If not, I think we can go into new business, Dr. Schneider, WCRI.
So WCRI has issued a number of reports. Since August, the first one had to do with high cost claims, and they limited these to back and shoulder. The back claims, the high cost claims, included neurologic complications, soft tissue and disc complications, and why they went wrong. And then the shoulder had to do with rotator cuff and arthritis. The back groups had five times more cost on an average claim, with $120,000 in medical expenses, twice the number of temporary disability weeks. 90% of the individuals that had these high-cost claims had significant comorbidities. Obesity, pain syndromes, mental health issues, and sleep disorders were identified in more of these claims than on any of the average normal expenditure claims. There was a lot of overlap as it had to do with neurologic back disorders that included disc disorders and stenosis. And so more than, there was usually more than one diagnosis that led to the treatment. Both shoulders and backs had higher utilization use with multiple providers after the index procedure. In other words, once these claims went wrong, they continued to go wrong and expending a significant number of resources long after the index injury and index procedure. And cases that had surgery had 8 times more likely to lead to high cost claims than cases that did not have surgery. Now, this is a mixed bag in the sense that obviously those that have surgery may have more severe injuries, but in the soft tissue disorders, interestingly enough, those that had surgery for only a listed soft tissue diagnosis still had high cost claims that could not be justified based upon the index injury. So I thought that was very interesting that it appears, number one, that there's long resource utilization in these cases, and that be careful who you operate on.
Mm-hmm. All right.
WCRI also had a report on AI, which is obviously a hot topic across all of the industry. So they identified things that AI should do. First, it should reduce administrative burdens, including more consistent processing of structured and unstructured data, automation of routine tasks, and prediction potential for outcomes and early interventions. It should also enhance speed, consistency, and accuracy of communication. It should prevent accidents with data loss and correspondence. And finally, it should improve personalized care and transparency. Has it done any of these things? We will wait and see. So they didn't identify any major breakthroughs, but they did say that those were the potentials.
All right. Advisory Council on Workers' Compensation report.
Is Troy with us? No? Okay.
He is not, but I can talk on it if you want me to, Dr. Snyder.
Go ahead.
If you want. Okay. I know that Troy said that they will not make a decision on anything until tomorrow. So we're a day early, which is not the story of my life. The story of my life is a day late and a dollar short. So, but we are a day early today. So we don't have anything really to report unless you know anything differently, Dr. Snyder.
NCCI recommended a 2% reduction in lost costs analysis. Both of the consultants that the committee has recommended a larger decrease, and so the committee will vote tomorrow on whether to recommend to the insurance commissioner a reduction of 2% or greater.
Okay. Right. Overdose report for Tennessee.
The Office of Overdose Surveillance Program released a report October the 3rd. The key points were that in 2024, 2,473 Tennesseans died of drug overdose. This, however, was a 31% decrease from the year before. Most of the overdose deaths were related to contaminants in expected pills, including fentanyl. And so that's been the biggest issue, is contaminants in the cocaine and in the opioids that are presently cocaine, heroin, and the opioids that are coming into Tennessee.
Right. Looks like it's going down though, so that's good. We'll see what 2025 brings, right? Hopefully
Correct.
Better. All right, what about the THC report?
So the American College of Surgeons released a report, a research report on the six-year analysis of one Ohio county that showed that 40% of deceased drivers in motor vehicle accidents tested positive for THC.
Wow.
That is a huge number.
Wow. All right.
So the second part of the takeaway was that the high rate of THC positivity remained consistent over the 6 years of the analysis and was unaffected by the state's legalization of recreational marijuana during the study period. So even before they authorized recreational marijuana, the significant numbers of patients and significant numbers of deceased drivers were positive for THC. So it doesn't appear to have anything to do with whether there's recreational marijuana approved or not in a state.
Interesting. All right. Any questions? Any comments?
Well, the only question I have is to the rest of the committee. If there's other subjects that you would like us to cover or to investigate, please let us know. I try to bring important things and to the committee. I hope it is valuable for you, but I also am looking for what the committee would like to hear.
Okay. Bob, do we know of all these overdose deaths on opioids, how many occurred with people taking them at the dosages they were supposed to take and no aberrant behavior or misuse, and it was simply from the morphine equivalent dose?
No, I don't think that it broke it down by there were a lot of combination of people that were taking cocaine and opioids.
All right. It sounds like most of the deaths involved aberrant behavior, it sounds like, right?
Yes.
It would seem to me as the physical therapist on this board, or on this committee, that the multiple studies showing the reduction in opioids, the reduction in testing, the reduction in sticks, and the reductions in surgery, and the relative functional outcome that is equal to certain kinds of surgical procedures would be positively influential with ODG with regards to 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 10 weeks, or visit guidelines that are arbitrary and not taking into account functional outcomes with regards to work or with regards to the reduction in the use of opioids and in the use of surgery with the use of physical therapy. So not sure how to proceed on that because it takes a lot of research, but it seems linked.
We have identified that. Yes, we have identified that to ODG in the past, and we'll do so again.
Okay, I can get you some other studies because I'm not researching like Dr. Talmadge. I wish I was as good as Dr. Talmadge at it, but I will definitely get you some more. So anyway,
thanks, Dan. All right. Any other comments, questions? We can move into announcements. Do we have any announcements? No? It looks like our next meeting is Tuesday, February 10th. And then we have another one scheduled already for Tuesday, May the 5th, 2026. All right, mark your calendars.
I want to thank everybody for their participation and their interest. We do need all of the feedback and input that you give us. And I guess before we adjourn, just wish everybody a happy holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas, oh, yes. New Year's.
Yeah. Merry Christmas. Happy
you too.
Thanksgiving.
Yep. Happy holidays, everyone. All right. Are we ready to adjourn, Dr. Snyder?
Yes. Thank you. Thank all you right. for sharing.
You're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay.
Have a good one, everyone.
All right. Thank you.
You.